And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books, episode number 14?
Month 5.
Goodness.
Month 5, yeah. We are still alive and kicking. Thank you so much for tuning in. And please tell your friends, your families, even your enemies. Tell them about this show.
Absolutely.
Especially your enemies.
Yes.
We are an equal opportunity download.
Yes. We are broadcasting live from the greatest restaurant in all of the District of Columbia.
It's the best restaurant
Chatter.
At the corner of Wisconsin and wherever we are.
Wisconsin and Jennifer.
Yes.
Jennifer with one end. Yes.
Just inside the city line.
Yeah. Just inside
the city line.
It's
the absolute best restaurant on that corner.
We are, and it's, by the way, it's a gorgeous day.
It is.
In that it is not raining or snowing.
This is only the second time of every show we've had that it has not been raining.
I think you're right.
Spectacular.
I think you're right.
Yes.
We're here with David and Michael, Mark Stern, and our guest, Admiral James Stavridis, who is our featured author this evening.
Very excited.
We could be on this air for 18 hours and not cover one-tenth of what he's accomplished in his life.
I'm so inadequate.
But we'll get to that. Admiral, we've got it. I know.
I feel myself getting dumber sitting next to him. I actually feel myself getting stupider. God.
I was going through some of these books over the last couple of weeks, and I was talking to my husband on the phone, and he asked me, oh, how's it going? I said, I should have gone to school. I should have gone to some of those classes.
A lot of reading I got to do.
Jeannie is a little under the weather, so we'll miss her this evening. And we're going to put a couple of the segments off that Jeannie had come up with.
Yes, it was some great ideas.
But we'll
hold her when she gets back.
I think she's gone next week, too.
I think she has gone next week,
I think she's going to be in the city by the bay.
Oh, she's
some
family
reunion?
Yes.
Big family reunion.
Yes,
so we'll push her segments off for a couple of weeks.
Sure.
And we'll have
she
a couple lesser segments.
She could call live from San Francisco, maybe.
Speaking of call-ins, we could have the whole McManus family call in.
That would be brilliant.
Okay, what's on tap for tonight? Well, first of all, we do have a wine of the evening.
Oh,
Ron
yes, please
gets
do
the
tell.
Wine of the evening,
do
which
tell.
Is who knew there was a Fess Parker vineyard? But there is Fess indeed. Fess
oh,
Parker.
The Admiral is raising his hand. He was aware of it.
You
how about
knew
that?
It?
Of course he
been
is.
Been there. Been there. He's Fess Parker
veteran. Okay. the chances of this happening.
He was a famous oneophile.
I did
wow.
not.
What is okay? I got to raise my hand. What is an oneophile?
That's a wine person.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, they call them winos where I was from.
Exactly.
That's what we call them.
How did he become a famous oneophile?
He became an oneophile because he came from an Italian family and grew up in and around the grape.
Holy cow. Well, okay, we can just stop the show now because it doesn't get more embarrassing from now
on, David. I was going to make Marshall Dillon jokes, and I can't do it because, again.
Well, from the Fess Parker Vineyard, we have Frontier Red, Lot 96, Wine of the Evening. It has all these things about Appalachian and this and that, which I don't understand. But it did get an 87 from your wine advocate, recommended by your Washington Post, and it looks lovely. So thanks to the Fess Parker Vineyard. I guess his grandson, Spencer Schull, was here. He wrote across the bottom.
Okay.
Okay, so that's Wine of the Evening.
I just had to look up Fess Parker. I knew the name. Hell is for Heroes. That was the movie I just
David.
Watched that the other day.
Yeah.
I was... Sorry. That was my own personal project.
It's a great name. But I think Fess Parker, I think horses, which I love. But I think dust
Westerns.
And leather.
Westerns.
And that's really not the connotation
sure.
you really want
no.
with wine. But
no.
okay. If it works for him.
Depends on the terroir.
Right.
Spelled, Michael. Spelled. Go ahead.
T-E-R-R-O-I-R.
Excellent. We'll come back to you for another French pronunciation
there you go,
in a little while.
Because we have one.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're going to do a book report update. David?
Yeah.
Not yet.
Okay.
We're going to talk a little bit about the 12 books that the New York Times says we should be reading in March, Stick Kneading Needles in My Eyes.
Yeah.
And then we're going to spend as much time as we possibly can with Admiral Stavridis, because amazing life, amazing service, and incredible books. And we also have Deserted Island recommendations. But we have a couple of pieces of news.
Uh-oh.
Most importantly, we talked about this before the show, we have gotten terrific shout-outs from public libraries. Thanks
That's
to
awesome.
Michael's shout-out last week for D.C. public libraries, and I think I talked about my public library, but mostly because of Michael. We've gotten so many great tweets and emails, and somebody stopped me at the Safeway the other day saying, I heard you all talking about D.C. public libraries. They're wonderful. And people really appreciated that, Michael. And that started a second drumbeat looking for a great children's author to have on the show.
Other
so anybody
me.
Listening, of the 12 of you listening... It helps if they're local. It helps if they're local.
There's
but
lots of
a children's author, and I'm already thinking of the things we could do in the restaurant. And it starts with balloons.
Just stop, Tori, at the Safeway and share all of your recommendations.
Yes.
Could we? Here we go. And most importantly, next week, we have a sponsor. We have
very
a sponsor.
Excited.
It's our first sponsor for Chatter on Books. So, so far, they are the official sponsor.
Chico's Bail Bond?
Calvert Wine.
We're waiting for the callback on that.
Calvert Wine and Spirits.
Yes.
Calvert Woodley Wine and Spirits.
That's La great. Cheeserie.
Why is this buried at this point? This should have led.
Should have led.
La Cheeserie.
Exactly.
La Cheeserie.
The original.
Yeah. Had great conversation with Michael Sands recently. And if you have not been over to Calvert Woodley on Connecticut Avenue lately, you should go by. It's a remarkable place.
It is the
and
best.
If you hang out there for half an hour, 45 minutes, as I did, the cast of characters coming in, because they do have a great wine. They have an incredible wine selection.
Oh, brilliant.
Incredible liquor selection. And then standing there listening to the people who work behind the counter talking about the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And I will get this right by next week, but I think they've been around for about 53 years. I think something like six of the full-time staff that have been there since the very beginning.
Wow.
The loyalty to the place and the products and the service is incredible. So we are thrilled to have them. We will have a big rollout next week.
If you want to see a modern-day dance, just go hang out on that corner and watch people getting in and out of that little parking lot.
Oh, there's a whole thing about the parking and when you could park there and people, yes. Michael would tell you, and people who come and park there in the morning thinking the store isn't open yet so they can park there, which they cannot.
No.
So, but we got that.
Awesome.
Okay, David.
Yes.
Back to the show. Book report update. Well, yeah, here's some, had a lot of challenges in your life lately.
Notice which of your parents is not pressuring you about this report.
No, not at all. I
don't know. Now, just remind people what you were tasked.
I'm supposed to do a book report on the...
You sound like an 11-year-old talking to your mom. Well, I was supposed to do a book report.
Well, it's a book, and it's about some things, and there you
go.
It's
got a great cover.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes.
Ken Kesey. I don't know if you heard about the pleurisy outbreak this weekend.
It was brutal.
It was really, really bad.
The gas leak on 95.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you're reading the email?
Yes. I am, yeah.
Yeah, read the email. Read
Sugar Bites.
Sugar
I don't
bites.
Think I've heard that word since Mark Twain.
Right.
And the weekend angioplasty.
Weekend
sorry
angioplasty.
About that.
I had to go in, get a little stuff cleaned out.
That was unscheduled, yes.
Yeah, you know, stuff happens.
Yeah.
What can I tell you?
Have we begun? And I'm not pressuring.
I have begun, okay. But I feel inadequate. I do not feel prepared because I know I will be quizzed not only on the substance, but the overall meaning of the book.
There'll be no grilling. We just want to hear you present what
Speak
you took away
yourself.
From the book.
I know, but I could. I've seen the movie, but you guys don't seem to want that.
Well,
you want the actual book review.
Thinking I might get pulled out of the bullpen for this one, I started reading some about it, about Ken Kesey, which I knew a little bit about
Ken
him.
Ken Kesey's sort of a really
remarkable.
Yes. One of the Merry Pranksters.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
But did you know what he did when he was at Stanford?
I didn't know. I don't know.
A couple of things. One, he participated in experiments being done by the U.S. Army.
Oh, well, yeah.
About the psychedelic drugs and things like that. And that became that.
Hung out with the Grateful Dead, I believe.
Sure.
As you do.
That was not in my reading, but okay. And
I want to do some further
supposedly,
research. Yes, different sources.
Yeah. Why do you need more than a Wikipedia? Supposedly, his inspiration for the book came from working. He worked in the psychiatric ward of a hospital there. And that's when
that
he... At night, which is always a great
scene. Always the best time to work
at
a psychiatric hospital.
Two words.
Hospital.
Yeah.
Nurse Ratchet.
There you
that's
go.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Right?
Yes.
Just,
Come on, let us watch the world.
So
series.
It's pretty, I think you'll find it fascinating. Once
I'm
you dig
sure
into
it's
it, Mr.
Going to
Aldrich.
Be very good. I'll be sure to really, really get into it this week. It's on my to-do list.
At least just open it up to the middle of the book and try and read two pages so you can comment on the style of the writing.
There you go.
Do we have any guesstimates on when? I know
I'm thinking,
Professor Stern is putting no pressure on you.
I am thinking...
Stern hopes you never read the book.
I'm thinking...
No, that's not true.
I'm thinking Major League All-Star Break is probably the best time for me.
Anybody listening, if you have a child who did a book report on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, send it in. David could crib from that.
Yeah. No,
read one chapter for every Bryce Harper home run through the month of April.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. It's not like I'm involved in a startup company or anything.
Can we have a statute of limitations in Washington, D.C. about when we stop talking about Bryce Harper?
Yeah, we can after this week.
November, okay. I think, after the season's done. By the way, I just want to read this from Wikipedia.
Yes.
At a Grateful Dead concert, soon after the death of promoter Bill Graham, Kesey delivered a eulogy. So there you go.
Oh, there you go.
See, I got his name right.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't say Kesey.
He was very, very close to them.
Huh.
They all but
makes
all,
a lot of sense.
It was all in the Bay Area. They were all hanging out together.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's got I want the story on all of these bands, all these people like this. just drugged out of their minds 97% of the time. Who was the intern? Who was the munchkin who was driving them around, picking them up off the street? Somebody had
Penny
to.
Lane.
Yes, right? Penny Lane. Penny Lane was doing it. I believe that is 100% right. Yes.
All right, David will not have time to be reading.
I'll read at some point soon.
What the New York Times.
Some of these 12 books that are must reads by the New York Times.
Must read. So I'm just going to read some titles and some brief descriptions.
Who
and I'd like.
Comes up with you these
guys,
lists?
Thank you, people at the New York Times. But then you can tell me the chances, likelihood of reading, not reading, no bleeping way. Mm-hmm. So the first one, okay, me maybe. An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. Yep. By Alex Kotlowitz. I'm going to get that wrong. Now,
no,
David,
right.
You said you've read something else?
I did. I read There Are No Children Here. I've read Alex Kotlowitz's other book, and it's about a family that grew up in the Henry Horner homes, which are just simply the worst public housing project I have ever seen in my life. Now, the reason I know this is because the Henry Horner homes were located right across the street from the old Chicago Stadium, where the Bulls played. And I did a story in 1991 when I was at the Washington Post. I went to George Solomon and said, I want to do a story on these people who live across the street from Michael Jordan.
Oh, my gosh.
Michael Jordan is in their neighborhood 50, 55 times a year. Not only can they never get into the arena and see him play, their world is gone. It's completely... There's no connection between their world and Michael Jordan's world. Nothing.
Yeah.
And they are a block away. They're half a block away. And I went into the Henry Horner homes, and I talked to people, and I remember it being noon, and it was pitch black because all of the lights in the apartment, in the whole house apartment building had been knocked out. And I said, why are there no lights working? And they said, well, but this makes people easier to rob.
When they get
off the elevator.
Good Lord.
And I remember that, and so I've always been fascinated by that particular housing project, and read Alex Kotlowitz's book, and it's a very sad, but
important
there is some
book.
But there's some hope in it. Uh-huh. And the gist of it is, if you can get these kids out of here, they have a chance, but you got to get them out.
Got to get them out.
Well, I don't know if there's hope in this, because this talking about profile. We all know the numbers for Chicago. We always hear about the numbers of hot men. It's just they become numbers.
Right?
Yeah. But this talks about actually profiles the people who have been impacted by the victims, the family. Sounds terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is about Chicago. Then we'll go right past Daisy Jones and the Six, which I hear is like a sad ripoff of Fleetwood Mac's story.
Ah.
Right?
Okay.
Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Yeah.
All right.
Then
blow past that.
Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law by Preet Bharara, whose name I always mispronounce.
I think it's
but
Bahara.
Okay. I think the H is in the wrong place then, his name. But if you turn on your TV at any time, day or night, you will see him on there. Former prosecutor from the Southern District of New York. Now everybody knows his SDNY. I think there are going to be T-shirts now.
Yes.
SDNY. And if this is truly, the New York Times says he outlines how the justice system works and makes a case for why these bedrock principles are critical to society. If he actually does that in the book, it might be interesting.
Mm-hmm. But, or is there a
there's
but
there? There's a but. There's a pivot coming.
But you don't think he will.
Every time I see him on television, I think, what's he running for?
Oh. Right. So this is to position himself.
Can I just say?
Yeah. Chances of reading
full
it, David?
Comment. I mean, I probably won't read it, but the wife loves his podcast. Loves his podcast. So.
Because?
More than ours?
Because she thinks he's very smart, and he presents complicated issues in a way that makes sense to people who aren't as smart as he is.
Okay.
Has she heard us break down One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Not yet. Not yet, apparently.
Michael Kornheiser, would you ever read this book?
That's a hard pass for me.
Okay, got it.
I wouldn't even read a review of this book.
Okay.
At least with American Summer, I'd like to read it. I'd like to carry the book around and show people that it's in my bag.
Dog-eared copy in your back pocket.
Right. Those should be our three categories. Yes, no, I'd like to read it. All things being
equal. I haven't
read
your book, but I heard it's very good.
Okay, Mark, would you like to do the reading of Gingerbread? Because if I do, I'll just
Where's Gingerbread? So what page is that on my
syllabus? I'm on page five of nine. Sorry, I killed a lot of trees printing this out.
Gingerbread by...
Nah.
Okay, Helen... by Helen.
Yeah.
Oyemi.
Oyemi? Is that how you pronounce it?
Oyeyemi?
Oyeyemi?
I don't know.
Harriet and Perdita, the mother and daughter at the heart of this novel, are passionate about their gingerbread recipe, which is beloved in Harriet's distant home country. The story... What home... Okay, sorry. I have questions already. The story takes on the feel of a fairy tale. From the distant land known as La Plata. As the women navigate family history, jealousies, grudges, and...
Right?
I'm sorry. Sorry, did I drift off there?
Yeah. It just screams book club, right? It just screams book club.
And can I just make a side note about this list that the New York Times felt, you know, that they had to, like, thrust upon us? This is the stuff that we are anti, okay? We're against this. It's the very nature of the book clubs. It's like, this is a very important thing. It's unbelievably boring, and we're going to be very obtuse about everything. And it's just like, this is the stuff that I despise.
So let's break this down. Beloved in Harriet's distant home country. Home country, to me, just simply becomes a placeholder as we are going to throw that back into our own experiences, and we navigate our own family history, jealousies, grudges, and more. Boom, that's the book.
There you go.
Wow.
Boom.
Go, Michael.
Saved us so much
time. That must be a really good gingerbread. Do you think it includes the recipe?
Probably.
Because I'd read that book.
It does, yes.
If Helen's listening, if she would like to be here as a featured author, then only if Ron and Liz agree to make gingerbread in the kitchen at the same time as we're doing
it. And I promise I will apologize in person.
I like Road to Perdition. Does that help me at all? That was a great movie.
That was a great movie. Tom Hanks.
Oh, none of us are going to heaven. Oh, what a great line. Wow!
Like that.
Can we skip past Lot Stories by Brian Washington?
Yes, please. Yes, it's your show, Tori.
I think we just did.
Okay, then Michael, on page 6 of 9, you're the only one who knows how to pronounce Madame Forsades.
This is like a Passover Seder. You have us skipping around reading.
Yeah. Participatory. Everybody gets a medal.
We are on page
6 of 9.
6 of 9. All right. And which book am I reading?
Madame, whose last name I can't pronounce.
Why did you set me up for this?
Lynn Olson.
Because you can pronounce the name.
Exactly.
I still. Madame. All right. Madame Forsade, Secret War, The Daring Young Woman Who Led France's Largest Spy Network Against Hitler, by Lynn Olson. Olson, the author of Last Hope Island and Citizens of London, tells the fascinating and little-known story of Marie Madeleine Forsade, imprisoned twice by the Nazis. She kept her network together and supplied critical intelligence to Britain and the United States, even as the Gestapo killed hundreds of its agents.
I'll read
Mark,
this.
There you go.
I'll read this.
Right up your alley.
I like this.
Right up your alley.
It's so sad. So many people wanted to spy on and kill Hitler, and nobody could get it done.
Yeah, nobody really got the job done. Yeah.
They all messed up. None of them got it done. There's like 18 books about this.
No.
What are you doing?
With Maxwell Smart said, you know, I believe I missed by that much.
The Old Drift by Namwale Sirpal, I think I'm pronouncing that correct, is about three Zambian families. This I would read. I'm fascinated with Africa. I've been to Zambia. I'm fascinated with it. So that I would actually read. It's about three different families and how their lives
intersect
over generations.
Ooh,
so that would be good, right?
I do like that.
That would be a good one.
Good, yes.
That's a good airplane read. The River. Did anybody go far enough to read this one?
You all did, in on The River.
Oh, my God. Are you?
All in.
Isn't this isn't this a ripoff of that Helen Hunt movie?
In this modern-day survival tale, a canoe trip in northern Canada turns grim for two college friends after a wildfire breaks out near their route. Things become even more dire when the friends wade into a domestic dispute between a man and a woman. See what they did with wade? It's being used in multiple ways.
Yes, I like
they
that.
Encounter on the trip, and the novel takes on the urgency of a thriller.
This is a ripoff of a Helen Hunt movie.
Again, I read Deliverance many years ago.
The River Wild?
Is that what it was called?
But a Helen
Hunt. That was
Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep and Kevin Bacon, I believe.
But this is Deliverance 2.0.
Oh, it is.
Right.
Now, I did read, by the way.
Who wrote that?
James
Tuck?
No, James. Not Heller. He wrote Catch 22, right?
Yeah.
What was it? James Dickey wrote Deliverance.
Go. Yes. Yes. Now, if one of the guys in the book, Michael, is named Wade, is that even better?
Ooh.
Exactly.
Wade Miley?
Anybody say squeal like a pig? Or that didn't turn out well.
Talk about movies that couldn't be made today.
For anybody. Yeah.
All right. I'm skipping The Art of Edward Munch. Sorry. And White Elephant. Sorry. Okay. Gotta skip right. Okay, Scream. Wait. White Elephant, actually, by Julie Langsdorff, this last one.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. This sounds like my neighborhood. The construction of a looming McMansion, the novel's namesake, in Willard Park upends what had been a quiet suburb. Langsdorff's wry debut captures the fallout as neighbors turn on one another. Trees are set on fire, and the town seems poised to fall apart.
This does seem right up your alley.
There's
your
street behind me, and neighbors, I refuse to participate in the listserv because I would blow things up, but my husband reads me excerpts occasionally, and it started a couple weeks ago. Somebody bought a house, tear down, evidently took down more trees than was anticipated.
Mm.
The onslaught begins.
Old sycamores.
Somebody's trashing somebody else, and she inadvertently hits reply all instead of responding to the one person. Then the whole town read it. So, things are burning.
See, I would read that book.
Yes.
The story
about
the,
Somerset?
Oh, yeah. The story of the reply all. Quite relevant. I feel like we get this book every year. You can only ever see it in hardcover. And this is a politics and prose display book. And if you've been through this city, you know what I mean by that.
Yep. Put on your 38-year-old cardigan sweater. You're set.
That is awesome.
Okay. And we will come back in a couple weeks with Jeannie's segments, which are fabulous ones. She has very, very good ideas for segments. And now, Mark, we take a break.
We do.
Correct? And then we come back with the Admiral.
With the Admiral.
Excellent.
Cannot wait.
Take a break. Come back.
And welcome back to Chatter on Books. For you, just moments, but for us, several minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Boy, it's a
and
shame.
And refills.
refills. And it's a shame that we don't actually air what goes on between segments.
Exactly.
But that's sometimes
all
the best
people need
to
know.
Should charge people for that.
Yeah, the internet show.
As David predicted, we're becoming even dumber as the minutes go by.
God.
Oh, I know I am.
You know how you really are smarter than many people, but when you read,
you are.
I think we're smarter than most people, but when you meet somebody who's really smart. The level of smartness.
We won't make the mistake again. We are back. We are happily back with Admiral James Stavridis, who is really a 21st century Renaissance man. And I just Google him, because the list of accomplishments in the military, in academia, in business now are truly remarkable, and it would take hours to go through all of them. But I have to say, one of the most remarkable things about my relationship with Admiral Stavridis is several years ago, I think I might have left the Pentagon. My mother-in-law, Helen Graham, lovely woman, born and raised in Florida, lives there now, just chit-chatting, we're catching up, and she was talking about her dear friend. She goes, oh, you know, my dear friend. And her son does something in the military. I'm not sure. He's a nice young man. He's a very nice young man. He was Admiral James Stavridis. And I said, yeah, I think he's done a few things in the military. Several combatant commands. My favorite title, NATO Supreme Allied Commander.
Well, that's a nice title.
That's a nice title. It's the best one.
Yeah.
Yes. Because it's the coolest. head of academia, head of the Fletcher School, probably the premier school in the country for international relations, now at the Carlyle Group. Author, Admiral, of at least 8 books so far. At least 8 books so far. You two, born in Florida, right?
Indeed.
Your dad was in the military, served in 3 wars. He was a Marine, right?
Yes, indeed.
How do you feel about you going to the Navy?
I am a child of a lesser god.
Yeah.
But, you know, my big goal in life was to become the winemaker at Fess Parker's. Yeah.
I think it's a possibility.
Yeah.
After your shameless plug tonight, I think
as long as they don't have a height requirement, I'm in.
What did
you have to? That's a visual joke. You have to actually be in the studio to get that. For all of our listeners, Tori Clark looks way down on Admiral Stavridis.
Not as much as I used to. I'm shrinking. What did you want to be when you were 5?
I wanted to be a cook. And I'll tell you why.
Again, a possibility.
It's in my future. It's Act 4. But I grew up in a Greek immigrant family that came here and opened a restaurant right out of Saturday Night Live.
What was it called?
It was called the Downtown Diner.
Nice.
In Allentown, Pennsylvania. And my grandfather built it, created it, and ran it. And I would go as a little guy there and be a busboy and then a waiter and then a prep guy and then a line guy, and he never let me actually run the line. So that's what I want to do before I check out.
They often have openings here
right
at Chatter.
Right here at Chatter, exactly. Could I do that?
Sure.
Michael, I might go right from here.
A couple of weekend stints.
Michael can help out. And then you thought maybe be a lawyer, right?
I did. Good for you. Your intel's excellent.
It's a great story about my also friend, Admiral Mullen.
Well, it is. I went to Annapolis, went out to sea, was on a group of ships, did my 5 years at sea, and then was promptly going to resign from the Navy. And I told my human resources professional, who was Admiral Mike Mullen. At the time, he was a lieutenant commander. Hey, I'm resigning. And he said, well, you know, what would it take to keep you in? And I said, well, I'm thinking about going to law school. If the Navy would send me to a law school, I'd probably stick around and be a Navy JAG. And
this was before the TV show.
Yeah,
yes.
Way before. And Admiral Mullen said, well, I don't know, I'll check on it. He called me back a day later and he said, you know, I got money for you to go to law school. And I said, great. I'm accepted at Yale Law School. How does this work? Do you send me the money and I pay Yale, or do you guys pay? He said, no, you're not going to Yale. He said, I got money for you to go to something called the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy.
That is so great.
I said, that's not a law school. It's a school of international relations. So long pause, paper shuffling around on his desk. And he said, look, I got money. It's got law in the title. Do you want to go or not? That's what kept me in the Navy. So I ended up getting a PhD in international relations and then had this long misspent youth in the Navy, and here I am.
And more than a misspent youth in the Navy. And you became the first non-general to be NATO Supreme Allied Commander, correct?
Yeah, as I always say, I was the 16th Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, which means there are 15 generals spinning in their graves right now. And you know, you were saying it's a great title. I'll tell you, it's great until you come home at night and you say to your wife, Laura, would you mind calling me Supremo? And it just doesn't work.
I can't remember who the Supreme Court justice was. It was one of the women. It's a true story. She was flying somewhere once, and she had papers out and books out, and there were lots of stickies on it and notes from staff. And the sticky said things like, you know, Madam Supreme, you need to check this box, or Madam Supreme, we need your opinion on this and that, whatever, in the stickies, right?
Okay.
And the person next to her finally said, oh, my God, I've never seen staff there. I'm sorry, I'm looking at your papers here, which she probably shouldn't have had out. I've never seen it be addressed that way. And she had to explain that she was.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I was a lowly assistant secretary of defense at the Pentagon. And the official, they were supposed to refer to you as Madam Secretary, which I always thought had a certain brothel feel to it. Like, oh, that's not really working. Do you miss the military?
Not at all.
Oh, come on.
Really? No, I loved it. I miss the sea. I miss being on the deep ocean, out of sight of land. I spent...
What does that say about your personality?
Nothing good. But it's where I read a lot of books. And I guess I added up the other day. I went back through my logbooks and added up actual number of days on the deep ocean. And it comes out to about 12 and a half years.
Wow.
But I miss it, you know? Mm-hmm. And when I was at sea, I missed my family, of course, and you miss the day-to-day flow of being in your country. But it's another world out there, and I enjoyed it deeply.
When you were first out there, pre-internet, pre-social media, certainly pre-internet, those kinds of things, how much could you correspond with, talk with your family?
Not at all. Yeah. You wrote letters, and I wrote, you know, hundreds, thousands of letters over those many years. And they would go out occasionally as the ship would come alongside another ship in a big bag. Mm-hmm. Eventually, they'd make their way home, and then eventually you'd get a letter back. It was the ultimate sort of delayed correspondence.
Yeah. And then pluses and minuses is that lack of correspondence,
I think,
right?
There are. And we see today in today's military the immediacy of contact that is afforded through not only their email connection, but also social networks, constant flow of information, and it's impossible for them to disaggregate from the world around them.
Yeah, and I think it makes for very interesting relationships for the families, because on the one hand, you think to yourself, oh, some young man or woman is deployed for 6 months at sea, but can talk to their family every day, and that sounds wonderful. And then you say, wait, this guy or gal deployed way out there doing important things on a ship should be focused on the job, not the spouse back home is saying, oh man, the pipes froze again, I need to fix it. It used to be the family back home dealt with it.
Yeah.
Just dealt with it. And now.
And it becomes incumbent upon the services and the department to manage the home front with the same professionalism that we ask our military to manage the operational front.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, let's talk about books. And again, I think 8 so far, another one coming out, which if we have time, we should talk about. I picked two of my favorites, The Leader's Bookshelf and The Accidental Admiral. The Leader's Bookshelf is incredible. And this morning I was mailing off copies to my kids, and maybe they'll actually read it because I begged them. But this is fascinating. I'll just start and you tell us more about it. But you interviewed a couple hundred admirals and generals and said, what are you reading, what have you read, what books were important to you? And then you curated the package and came up with 50. And the way this is constructed is remarkable, because here's the person with whom you spoke about these books, they talk about a book, they talk about what was important to them, and then you talk a little bit more about the lessons learned. But What surprised you when you talk to these people? And there's so many names people would recognize in here. McChrystal, Stan McChrystal, I love his. But what surprised you as you were talking to them when they told you what they loved and adored in terms of reading?
What surprised me were the number of novels, the number of fiction books in this, which I find so powerful. And I'm a huge consumer of fiction. Two-thirds of the books I read are novels because I think a novel transports you into another dimension, another character. It's like a simulator. You can dive into a novel and say, here I am in the middle of the Battle of Salamis off the coast of Greece 2,500 years ago. What would I do in that situation? So I was pleasantly surprised at the number of novels. And I'll give you a good example of this. One of the novels in the book is To Kill a Mockingbird, which is an extraordinary
David's favorite book.
My favorite book of all time.
It ought to be read by everyone every 10 to 15 years because it is a completely different book. And you'll agree with this, I think, David, when you read it at 15 and you read it at 30 and you read it at 45, and I just read it as a 60-year-old guy, it's so totally different. You identify with different characters. You draw more from it. Above all, you bring so much more to the book. Now, that's maybe the last book on earth you would think would be on a list of books by admirals and generals, but there it was. And it's because it's a book about integrity and about picking the hard right thing to do instead of the easy wrong thing to do. It's a gorgeous novel.
Yeah, and there are some obvious, Sir John Keegan, right? Extraordinary thing about Sir John Keegan, never in the military.
Nope.
Right? The influence of that man. You hardly walked into an office in the Pentagon and not see his books on there or people who had talked with him and met with him. Those are the obvious ones. But talk about Stan McChrystal's pick.
He did Killer Angels, I think.
He did Connecticut Yankee.
I'm sorry, Connecticut Yankee, excuse me, which is also one of my favorite books, is a novel, Mark Twain, set about 150 years ago. And we think of it as a book about the imagination. The setting is that a highly intelligent engineer from the 1850s goes back in time to the time of King Arthur. And by definition, he ought to be the smartest person on earth, right? He knows he knows everything. He knows mechanics and fluid energy, and he knows the world is round. I mean, he knows everything, but he can't get anybody to believe him. And it is a book about, and the reason Stan picked it and the reason I love it is it's a book about how hard it is to be an innovator, about how you may have all the right answers, but if you can't communicate them and get them across, your mission will fail. And, of course, anything by Twain is brilliant, but I think that particular book, top of my list. So I was glad to see it.
Yeah, I'm not surprised Stan McChrystal picked it, and I wish I had been that smart back when I worked at the Pentagon, which I wasn't, because one of the biggest challenges pre-9/11 was telling a lot of really smart, dedicated, talented people, hey, the world has changed. Yeah. It has changed dramatically, and the threats we're facing are very different, so we need to do things differently. And people are going, no, things are pretty nice here. We don't need to change. That's a brilliant choice.
Yeah, another novel in the list is Orson Scott Card's marvelous book, Ender's Game, which is science fiction and is a terrible movie. I highly don't recommend
the
movie.
It's dreadful.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it's possibly the worst film I've seen in many, many years. But it is a fabulous novel, and it's a story about the need for a cyber force, a space force, and to rely on youth who don't have preconceived notions about everything to save us. Those are three pretty powerful ideas, and they come out of a novel, not a CIA report.
Yeah, poetry. He's the easiest guest ever. Just one word, boom, he's off. Go. Poetry.
Well, in the book, I throw out a couple of different poets, but my favorite poet is William Butler Yeats, and we could go on and on about Yeats, but in particular his poem.
You could, we couldn't, because we don't know enough about
that. The Second, Coming.
Yeah, Yeats is brilliant. Yeah.
Well, you know the expression, slouching toward Bethlehem, right? Yeah, so that is from The Second Coming by Yeats, which is a poem about the center not holding, about things falling apart. It begins with an image of a falcon
That's right.
That moves wider and wider in its gyre, not listening to the falconer. And it's about a world, and you have to think about it in the context of when he wrote
it. It was written right around World War I, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And he sees correctly that the 20th century is going to be about widening circles and disaggregation. And we managed to put all that kind of back together at the end of the Second World War, but I'll make the observation, many have done so, that that disaggregation is starting again.
Sure.
And we ought to be very concerned about that. And again, poetry, I think, because of the economy of the use of word, is so powerful in conveying fundamental ideas. So, yes, there's poetry in the Leader's bookshelf as well.
Economy of word, Hemingway, you're a big fan?
I am. And I recognize there are negatives in the Academy about Hemingway, his misogyny and his alcoholism and et cetera. But I think for lean, powerful prose, go back and read The Sun Also Rises, set in the 1920s, this lost generation. It's an extraordinary novel that begins with a fly fishing trip in the Pyrenees Mountains and descends to the bullfights and ends up in Madrid over a long boozy lunch. He drinks three bottles of wine at Botin's. And
you from the Fess Parker Vineyard.
Yeah,
all
sure.
from the Fess Parker Vineyard.
Sure. As you do.
So, yeah, Hemingway, I think, is someone who will be read again and again and again.
Yeah. Michael, any crossover, much crossover, when you think about what young people are being asked to read these days in school? Any crossover with some of these books that we're talking about?
Oh, definitely. I think Ender's Game is still very popular with today's youth, and there's actually some problematic scenes within that novel that are being explored by kids today because they have a better understanding about sort of what happens with, to put it simply, you know, when boys are acting up. But there's definitely crossover. If I were recommending something, I would definitely focus on the poetry, just because the control over syntax, of order of thought, I think really is going to play with that as well, rather than these kids today. And sorry to always bring it back to kids, but we see endless amounts of words, because you don't necessarily have that word count the same way you might have had by an editor back in the day. So I really love trying to see that message in poetry. That's why I always come back to Ulysses.
The poem?
Yes.
I love that poem. I think it is, because it's a novel also. It's a long, grindy novel to try and get through. But the poem, Ulysses, is
a message
for us all.
To meet and dole unequal laws unto an unequal race.
I think we should leave Michael and the Admiral alone together.
Yeah. I do.
Travel that world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move.
So what's so wonderful about that poem is you bring it up to, this is, again, outside the box, you give it to kids who do not really... They might understand the story of Odysseus. They might know that Ulysses is this novel, but they're very critical about that hero who comes back and is this sort of lost, this wandering lost soul, the absent father, the absent husband, versus, say, if you give it to an older generation, where they see that hero who is bound to duty and has that itch to go back out to that deep sea.
Again and again and again. And by the way, current novel, bouncing off this, is Circe by Madeline Miller,
yes,
which is fabulous. It tells the story of Ulysses from the viewpoint of the witch Circe.
Wow, that's great.
Bewitched him on his return to Ithaca. It's a fabulous novel if you have not read it, and it touches many
like
of the themes.
It's like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. I love that.
Yeah.
David, you had a question?
I am always curious about the application of leadership skills or leadership lessons learned in the military that are perhaps transferable to civilian life. I would imagine that there is a lot of, if you think of a Venn diagram, there's a lot that overlaps. But is there a difference between the type of top-down military leadership that civilians think of and a kind of broader civilian leadership, which is much more about fraternity, collegiality, shared ideas, making sure that everybody has input so that people don't feel like they're left out or marginalized?
I think it's a blend, and the military that many civilians perceive was the military of the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. you know, totally top down, my way or the highway. Today's military is certainly not Google, where my daughter works, right. which is like highly and is highly overpaid.
Right.
The military of today is very collegial mm-hmm. and is about team building. And Stan McChrystal's book, Team of Teams, mm-hmm. is a pretty good example of this. You see it the most, David, in Special Forces, mm-hmm. which are smaller, more elite, more intimate. But even across the big muscle machines in the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, the big Navy at sea, mm-hmm. you see much more of that transfer of collective thinking. No one of us is as smart as all of us working together. Mm-hmm. When you ultimately go into the crucible of combat, it is and has to be a very top-down
right.
determinant.
Yeah. Right. One of the most, I think it's still true. Years ago, one of the few things I ever worked on in the military before I went to the Pentagon was about recruiting. So it was the late 90s, tech boom, hard to attract young, bright people. But long story short, we did this amazing research, and we would talk to kids who were signing up for the military the first time and say, why are you joining? And they'd give you 50, 60 different reasons, right? Mm-hmm. I need a job. I want to get an education. On and on and on. 50, 60 different reasons.
Yeah, the food.
And then the food's fantastic. And then you'd go back, for those who actually joined, and you'd go back 12, 18 months later, the ones that had stayed in. I think it was at 18 months, and say, okay, why are you in the military? And it boiled down to two or three things. And the most powerful thing was, I'm part of this community, something mm-hmm. bigger than myself.
Absolutely.
And that is the glue that holds
so
it all
together.
So
the book that illuminates that, and it's also part of the 50 books in the Leader's Bookshelf, is called Gates of Fire. Mm-hmm. Great title, right? By Stephen Pressfield.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the Battle of Thermopylae, where these 300 Spartans go mm-hmm. and hold off an entire Persian army. And they're led by Leonidas. And at that battlefield, that ancient battlefield, there are two monuments today that still exist. One says, and this is where the term comes from, go tell the Spartans. Mm-hmm. One says, go tell the Spartans, stranger passing by, that here, faithful to their laws, we lie. That's one. The other one is very simple. It just says in Greek, molon labe, which means in Greek, come and get it. And this was the response when the Persian king offered Leonidas and his 300 Spartans. He said, you've fought well. Lay down your arms, and I will grant you all free passage back to Spartan. Mm-hmm. The response was, molon labe, come and get
that. That is great.
I believe that was transferred to nuts in the Second World War, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
At the Battle of Bastogne.
Yeah, that's great.
But to Tori's point about why people want to be in the military.
Why they stay. Mm-hmm.
Why they stay and why they will go into combat. And this is John Keegan also in The Mask of Command and The Face of Battle, his two brilliant books. They don't do it for the flag or the country. They do it for the man or the woman standing
right
next
to them.
To them. Yeah. And at some point in Gates of Fire, Leonidas is talking to his Spartans, and he says to them, in battle, the opposite of fear is not courage. The opposite of fear is love.
Mm-hmm.
Love for the person next to you.
That's
what keeps people in the military.
It was so illuminating to me. When I went to Walter Reed at the invitation of Kermit Washington, of all people, one time. And we went there, and we spent 3 hours with the families. And I remember this young man. I can never get this young man out of my mind. He was 24 years old. It was his third tour, and he had a grenade blown up, IED had blown up, and he was blind. And I was talking to him, and I said, look, I don't know you at all, but why on earth would you have gone back for a third time? You did your duty, man. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to go back again.
Mm-hmm.
He said, if I had left, the guys behind me wouldn't have known what to do, mm-hmm. and they would have died. And I just was, I am so inadequate in the face of that response. It's just amazing to me, the amount, to your point, the amount of real love that, mm-hmm. that people have for one another in combat. And it's something that if you're, and I've never had to do it, God,
right.
thank God.
It transcends everything
else.
Yeah,
you just, I have no words to describe how that works unless
you're
there.
You'll feel that way about this show and us 5 years from now. You'll feel feel that way. You'll never want to leave us behind.
Yeah, very true.
Oh, my gosh. I promise, Mark, I'm going to stay on time.
No, you know what? Do you see me looking at the clock?
No. This is fabulous.
This is so brilliant.
There was also a section in this book, The Leader's Bookshelf, which everyone should get. I really ordered 3 more copies today. Personal library. Yours is over 7,000 volumes?
Oh, wow. No, no. Mine is about 4,500, which is still a gentle madness.
Yeah.
But, yeah, about 4,500 books.
But you talk about the importance of personal and how
I
to,
do, and
how
I don't care
one.
If your library is 100 books or 7,000 books. We all ought to have a personal library.
Print or electronic? I know you address it in the book.
I do. I think there's a balance between the convenience of reading on a Kindle, and I certainly read on a Kindle, but when I am really captured by a book and I think it's something that people will read 20, 30, 50 years from now, I'm going to buy a good hard copy. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try and get a first edition. I'm going to try and find the author.
You have some pretty wonderful first editions, right?
I do. I have some Hemingways.
Oh,
I have Rudyard Kipling.
Oh, wow.
I have Winston Churchill. Cormac McCarthy, who I think is the greatest living American author. Every year I wake up when the Nobel is announced, hoping it's going to be Cormac McCarthy, who is an extraordinary chronicler of the American West. So yes, I will buy a book and own it. But again, it doesn't matter how many books you have. It's what they mean to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked the habit up from my father, who was a Marine officer, and everywhere he went in the course of his long career in the military, he would take a small box of books with him into combat in World War II, in Korea, in Vietnam, and he'd dip in and out of that box of books, and it meant everything to him in that context. So libraries are important, I think.
You travel a lot, though. So do you do Kindle? Do you do any audiobooks? I'm fascinated about audio versus print.
I do not do audio. I think if I had a long commute, I would probably do audio.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I do marvelous podcasts like this one constantly.
It's all downhill from here.
I listen again and again to these podcasts because they're so amazing. But I do not do books on audio. I really do find the act of reading very important. But to me, it doesn't matter whether I have a book physically in my hand or a Kindle. So when I go on a trip, I'll download a bunch of books and I'll plow through them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I get on a long-haul flight. I'm not going to watch the movies. I'm going to read the books.
David's awesome. Going to get on a flight and watch One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I've already watched it. I'm going to read the book.
Just briefly on The Accidental Admiral. I would retitle this. I would call it The Unexpected Admiral, because the title I know refers to you should have been a lawyer, but you go into the Navy.
Right.
You shouldn't have been NATO Supreme Allied Commander, those kinds of things.
I could have been a cook.
Again,
I could have been somebody on the line at Chatter.
The possibilities
here at
Chatter.
What do they make here anyway? What is the
food?
What is the best thing at Chatter?
My husband loves the grilled cheese.
Okay.
I love the burgers.
Great burger.
I think
great
the burgers
chili.
Are very
chili
good.
Chili is excellent.
Yeah, Wilbon's chili.
And omelets chili. In the morning are spectacular.
Yeah, they really are.
Really
yeah.
spectacular.
And come tomorrow. We'll do this on the Tony Show.
Desserts are pretty fantastic.
Yes.
Here.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. But Accidental Admiral, two things I want you to talk about, because it is not what people expect, and it's not what they think they're going to be hearing from you. Humor and innovation.
Sure.
You talk about the importance of humor.
Yeah, I think the three big qualities for any leader are, number one, humility. Number two, empathy, the ability to put yourself in the other person's shoes. And let's remember, empathy is also about empathizing with your opponents, because that's good intel, right? In other words, there's a pragmatic quality to that ability to project yourself into someone else's shoes. And the third thing is a sense of humor. And I found again and again in my career where I've seen my share of tough situations, from being in the Pentagon for 9/11 to being in combat multiple times, a well-timed, funny line can reduce tension. It bonds people.
Mm-hmm.
It helps move a group forward in a very difficult situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think that's the sense of humor piece. Innovation, I think Stephen Jobs said that the difference in the end between followers and leaders is the ability to innovate. It's coming up with that new idea. And Tori, you've worked many, many years in the Pentagon. You understand how great these colonels and captains, kind of these mid-career.
Really remarkable.
Really remarkable people. But I often say, what do you get when you put 8 colonels in a circuit, an electrical circuit? You get a circuit of infinite impedance. And you need someone to break the circuit. This is something Don Rumsfeld did very well. He would break the circuit and force innovation. And I think that's a quality of leadership that I put at the very top alongside the other three I mentioned.
I could go on for hours about this, which I won't. But innovation, it seems to make so much sense, and it seems so logical. Of course you need to figure out new and different and better ways to do things. When you're talking about a bureaucracy,
inertia,
the size and the scale,
right, exactly,
and the inertia of a place like the Pentagon, so hard.
It
so incredibly hard.
And the bigger the institution, the higher the level of inertia, mm-hmm, and the more difficult it is to crack it open and mm-hmm move forward. So I think especially in the military, where, let's face it, every morning 1.5 million people get up and put on the same outfit. Think about that. It's mm-hmm called a uniform.
Right.
Think about the word. We wear uniforms, mm-hmm, so we're all uniform. An organization like that desperately needs innovation, mm-hmm, and is also going to forcefully push it away. Another way to think about it is, in the military, when you want to get better at something, what do? You practice. You do it again and again and
right
again. You do repetitive. And that's okay. Let's do sports. Mm-hmm. If you're Larry Bird, you're in Indiana,
sure,
you're going to go out and shoot thousands mm-hmm and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of jump shots, and eventually you'll get better. But wait a minute. What if you break the circuit and maybe you change your technique? You use more backspin coming off your wrist. You mm-hmm break your wrist a little bit more. Or you use technology. You get a better pair of shoes that give you just that mm-hmm slightest bit of lift. The military never wants to do the second thing. The military's all about, let's go out and practice some more.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the danger. The seductive thing about that approach is that it works over time. But it fails you when the world is changing around
mm-hmm
you. And that's what you have to guard against.
Again, I could go on for hours here. This is fascinating.
Yeah,
so we're going to go to a break here soon. But before we do, what's the next book about?
It's called Sailing True North, 10 Admirals, and the Voyage of Character. So I've written about leadership. Leadership is what you do when you want others to follow you. Like, we're going to go out here into chatter. We're going to lead everybody into a street protest. Probably not going to happen. Character is leading yourself. It's looking inside yourself.
Right.
And dealing with your mistakes, your challenges, and overcoming them, and resilience, and those qualities we discussed a moment ago. So the book, Tori, takes 10 historical admirals going back 2,000 years and looks at each of them and the challenges he or she faced and how they resolved them in a character sense. Think of it as Plutarch's Lives Goes to Sea.
That's exactly what I was about to say. That's exactly what I was about to say. Oh, wait, before we go, Bill Harlow, one of my favorite people in the world,
the
a great public
ever
servant, the best ever, one of the greatest people in the world. Talk about a public servant extraordinaire. You and he some years ago pitched not-so-smart people about a novel.
We did.
On the Russians interfering in presidential elections.
This would never happen.
Would never happen.
No.
No. In 2016... strangely, due to some kind of immense computer error, I was vetted for vice president by the Clinton campaign.
Yes.
That's a whole long, strange...
That's another story.
Strange
concept. But that's another story.
It's, yeah. However, out of that experience of being vetted, I said to Harlow, you know, we had to write a novel about a case in which a vice presidential candidate is turned by the Russians. And we could call it Veep Stakes. And it would be incredible that the Russians could have a mole in the White House. So we wrote a lot of this up, and we sent it to our agent, and he said, "This is total nonsense." He used another word.
You can say it's a podcast.
So
you can say
ridiculous.
It.
You know, who on earth would back and write another leadership book, Stavridis? So that was the end
stick
of my
to your knitting.
Right.
So that was the end of my novel writing career. But you know, today, if we pitched it, they'd go, come on, why is it only the vice president?
Right.
Yeah. All right, you and Harlow have got to do it a book, though. That'd be great. Okay, we're going to take a break now, Mark. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yay. And
come
then
back.
We'll come back with Deserted Island.
That's right. No dessert, but Deserted Island.
Exactly.
That's right, it's signed. We're on the deserted island. Palm trees, coconut drinks.
So, Admiral, would you like to go first or last?
Please go first.
I want to go last.
Yeah, let him go last. We'll let him go last. Who would like to go first? Hands up.
Go ahead, Stern.
Oh, I'm going first. Okay,
yes.
Let me fade this music down. Well, in honor of the Admiral, I actually had a...
Simon the Sea Cat?
No, it's not Simon the Sea Cat, the most popular children's book
true
in America.
True story,
right
too,
now.
Right?
It is.
No,
yes,
no,
based
it's well-known in the British Navy.
Yeah.
Mark has a book out on it.
He became an able... Seaman,
Able
right?
Seaman, Able Seaman, Sea Cat,
it's a well-known story.
Did not end well for him when he got back to England, but it's an amazing story.
Yeah, he's a cat.
He's a cat. he's got eight other lives, right?
Six other lives.
The book I was going to recommend, but now because you talk about novels so much, I'm going to recommend a novel. I'm reading a book right now about Richard O'Kane called Clear the Bridge. Mm. He was the commander of the Tang,
a
submarine.
And it's a very famous story.
Yeah, and it's a brilliant story. But
you should tell what the setup
share.
Is. Or I can.
He was commander of a submarine, a very successful submarine. He's actually the XO, I believe, of the Wahoo, which
Correct.
Is another unbelievably successful submarine in World War II. And he was attacking a Japanese convoy, and the last torpedo, I think, that he fired, the last one they had on board, misfired and circled around and sunk his own ship. And a number of the crew were killed. He survived. A few of the crew members survived, and he was captured by the Japanese and spent the rest of the war in a prison camp. Is that just about it?
You've got it.
Yeah, it's a brilliant
story.
But
he ordered the ship to go down, knowing he would float away and be captured because he was so dedicated to his crew. Clear the bridge.
Yeah. So that I recommend that highly. But because you talk so much about novels. There is a book that I have read and I just loved. It's by Derek Robinson about pilots in the First World War called Goshawk Squadron from January 1918 to March 1918. And if you didn't know this, most people don't, the average lifespan of a pilot at that point was 2 weeks. And this is, it talks about the brutality of war, but with this dark humor. And just it really opens your eyes up because I've talked about this with the movie They Shall Not Grow Old.
Right.
This really humanizes the people from this time, which we don't really think of them except in like still photos and old grainy black and white movies. And it's a brilliant story. Derek Robinson is a very underrated author in my opinion. I love him to death.
I know there are books about the military, but there is so much done and there is so much good work done. I really feel like I need a personal librarian. Oh, Mark, you could be it. Never mind.
Come by my house. It's all my books. Yeah.
Michael?
Well, now I'm worried that I'm not choosing something that is literary enough. I'm choosing a very approachable novel. It is called, the author is Signe Pike, and it's The Lost Queen. It's going to focus on a forgotten queen. I believe her name is pronounced Langreth, but I could have that wrong. 6th century Scotland. She is the twin sister of the folk here who is the basis of Merlin, and she finds her country and her people at this crossroads where they are in between the old ways and this new emerging religion called Christianity. Mm. And it has beautiful language surrounding just the natural landscape. I recommended a book about 6 weeks ago. You asked what else I was reading, The River, and it had beautiful language about the river, and the river becomes a character. Here, the Scottish countryside, as they're going back and forth from what would stand to us as a city versus where her father's seat is in the country, the back and forth as this country takes on its own sense of self. So there is a mix of this magic from the old world, which is really just community, it's family,
mm-hmm.
It's the binds that keep you together with everyone who's trying to lift up that seat together versus Christianity. And lo and behold, they have a lot of the same tenets. They're just called different things. And there's a bit of romance in there if you want that love story. A lot of people will compare it to Outlander and that there is this hero that comes in and takes her heart, though she's promised to the main king's son. But it's a cool exploration as to how this young woman is able to play within the rules but still try and control what's going on around her from behind the scenes. You see these stories a lot, but I think in today's day and age, it's a powerful read. And I also think, just in terms of our own political landscape, you're trying to look at these two very different polar opposites where there are some common grounds, and you just have to use some different terminologies, and you can come to some, solutions at work.
Nice.
Nice.
That makes me want to read it. All right. Okay, David.
All right. In honor of our guests, there's been so many books that I've been thinking about this
week. Wow, this is really a tribute to you, Admiral. Yeah, people have never put so much work into...
No, but I'm just a moron.
This Rhode Island
I'm such a moron. No, I mean, there's a lot of books, but no, I remember, I still have, it's a book I read a lot called Enola Gay. It's about the pilots that flew, Colonel Tibbetts.
Yeah.
That flew that mission that dropped the first atomic bomb.
Fabulous.
And it's amazing about not only who they were, but who the people were on the ground. The bomb blew up over a doctor's clinic in Hiroshima. And they spent a lot of time telling you about who this doctor was.
Uh-huh.
And he was a wonderful, by all accounts, a wonderful man who did a lot of good work in the community. And it all leads up to, as I think it's Thomas and Max Morgan Witz are the authors, and they talk about the first millisecond after 8:16 a.m. in 1945 and how the world completely changed in that millisecond.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing to be like, the entire human history up until that moment, and then everything is different after that.
One millisecond. Maybe that's
and just the energy that was unleashed on that August day in 1945, and just how it just, you just can't even describe in any kind of meaningful way what happened to the people that were underneath all that energy.
I still wonder if people understand or appreciate the impact of that. I don't think they do.
No, I don't think they do. And here's the good news. I mean, horrific event. So many people die. But arguably, the fact that there was that pair of detonations really became an object lesson that I think managed to keep us out of a global war following the Second World War.
Yeah.
And even just to bring it to the present, you just saw over the last couple of days, India and Pakistan, India, Pakistan, bombs dropped, details at 11, and you're thinking, here we go. These are two countries that have 300 nuclear devices between them, but they're restrained. Why? Because of Hiroshima, because of Nagasaki. Yeah. So that's the silver lining, so to speak.
It's one of those great moral questions.
It's a powerful book. It's a powerful book.
It really is.
Really humanizes
it. Yeah.
And it's one of those great moral questions.
It is.
Right? It's one of those great moral questions. Okay, I'd be lying if I said I picked my book based on featured author tonight, Aaron Stravitas, but there is water involved, so maybe. But I think I talked about this a few weeks ago, The Amateurs by David Halberstam.
Oh, it's wonderful.
This tiny little book about
it.
The four guys, the rowing team, trying to win a gold medal in 1984, because I thought if I'm on a deserted island, it's going to be hard, and I'm going to need something to be gritty about.
Got to find a volleyball that you can name Wilson.
Exactly. I watched the start of that movie the other night, right before I got on a plane. I thought, that was a bad idea.
Don't do that. Yeah.
But I think, I don't know if I told the story, but I met David Halberstam in a green room once, and we're just chit-chatting about whatever and eating bad food. And big fan of yours, love your books. He's like, yeah. And I said, what's your favorite book of all your many? And most authors, the Admiral will say, oh, they're all like, my children, I could never pick one. He didn't miss a beat. He said, The Amateurs is my favorite book.
Right.
Favorite book ever. So, Admiral, thank you for being with us.
Yeah.
Thank you for these marvelous books. Everyone should get The Accidental Admiral.
Yes.
Everyone should get The Leader's Bookshelf. Everyone should get Sea Power, which is out. And then the book that comes out in October, they should get that. Thank you for your service.
Should I do my book?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's right. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah. Quite a wind-up.
It's called Pumping Irony, I think, is his favorite book.
So mine is like totally different than anybody else's. And it's Candide by Voltaire.
Wow.
If you have not gone
David,
back and
Michael's
read that,
ears perked up sure,
yeah. years ago,
sure.
you
yeah.
might have read it in high school.
Mm-hmm.
It's set in Europe during the Wars of the Reformation. The world's coming apart. There's a character, Dr. Pangloss, who becomes involved with Candide, our hero, and it's a tale of complete disaster at every turn, but resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And the last line in the novel is, but we must tend our garden. And it's a book about, to your point, if I'm on that desert island, I'm going to be hopeful, I'm going to be optimistic. As Colin Powell said once, optimism is a force multiplier.
Yeah.
And it's a marvelous, largely forgotten book from the Enlightenment that reads like it's ripped from today's headlines. Candide by Voltaire.
Awesome. Great recommendation.
Love it.
Thank you. I already did my wind-up. You're
yes.
fabulous.
Yes,
thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We could have you
everything.
Here for hours.
Yes.
Mark?
That's it for us.
Well, that is it for us.
Yeah, what do we got next week? What's coming up?
Next week, we talked about the story of one of the breaks. We have Chris Wilson. Fascinating story. Born and raised in D.C. Mm-hmm. Got in a lot of trouble when he was when he was 17 years old. Thought he was going to spend his life in prison. He got himself out with something he calls The Master Plan, and that is the name of his book, The Master Plan. I always forget the second half of the titles. My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose. Really remarkable guy. It's about redemption. It is about hope. It is about resilience. It's incredible. So should come. And people should listen. And thank you all very much. Thank you, Dustin and gang.
Yes, thanks for everybody for coming out. We'll be back here next week, next Monday at 5:30 at Chatter. We'll see you then.